This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Home in a Box, your podcast home for deep cut discussions of genre films of the VHS era. It is I, Chris Jordan, one of your grateful co-hosts and the man behind RetroMovieNerd.com, where this week we will have a review of a classic from 1976. It's Brian De Palma's Carrie. Big review this week, so be sure and check out the review right now over at RetroMovieNerd.com. Joining me, as always, is the man that I refer to as the Ayatollah of Pop Cultura, Mr. Joel La Puma.
And I will never get tired of that. And this is Joel La Puma, proprietor of Razor Candy at razor-candy.com. And in about a week and a half, look for a review of the upcoming Hudson Horror Show, which is taking place in Poughkeepsie, New York next weekend. It features Nightmare on Elm Street 3, Frankenhooker, Slaughterhouse, The Hidden, and the original Piranha.
I'm so jealous. Dude, I'm jealous. I want to be there.
It's their 15th show, I believe. They put on twice yearly in Poughkeepsie, a show of about five or six movies, and twice yearly at the Alamo Drafthouse in Yonkers, New York. They do a double or triple feature. The most recent one was just a month or so ago with Without Warning, The Vampire Lovers, and Candyman.
Yeah, stuff like that is great. I think maybe somewhere down the road, Joel, I don't know what it would take, but maybe we can get the founder of the show, the Hudson Horror Show, on. Maybe go home in a box. I don't know if he'd want to talk to us and let us know how he gets things like this going. And
Absolutely. Those guys are really accessible, really gregarious. They're happy to talk about it.
That's great. I'd be interested in that myself because I'd like to maybe someday start something like that. I don't know. I've expressed interest in that before, and I think it'd be cool. But anyway, we have quite a few people in our listening audience who are probably in the area that like to attend that. That'll be cool. But we have a big week for us here at Go Home in a Box, Joel, as we make our debut on the Place to Be Nation network of podcasts. So I want to personally give a thank you and a shout-out to the Rhode Island Ice JT himself, Justin Rosero, and Mr. Brad Warren for providing us with the opportunity to inform the masses of genre films, both good and bad. I know that there's a lot of Place to Be Nation people on the East Coast in New York, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Rhode Island. The Hudson Horror Show might be something that might interest them. So, yeah, check it out, guys.
Oh, absolutely. And I'll always keep our listeners informed of anything coming right now, being in Jersey. I'm sort of a nexus of all sorts of interesting stuff. Just this past Friday, I didn't get a chance to go, but at the Colonial Theater in Phoenixville, PA, where they filmed the theater scenes in the original Blob, they played Hello Mary Lou Prom Night 2.
Oh, yeah, awesome. Love that one. Cult classic there. I encourage our listeners to hit up these revivals and these screenings whenever they can because they're quite awesome.
Yeah, and everything, all these screenings we're talking about, they're all on 35mm, which is becoming more and more difficult to track down now that most theaters are converting to digital projectors.
Yeah, it's 35mm is going to be 35mm projection is going to be a lost art very soon. Projectionists are in the digital age. It's going to be hard to find one that actually knows how to work a 35mm film.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you've ever seen the inside of a projection room, those things are complicated, just remarkably so. And just the shipping costs alone. I mean, if we can get Chris Allo or some of the other Hudson Horror guys on the show at some point to talk about it, the shipping costs for a single film print, because it's multiple reels, it can run in the $70 to $100 realm.
Wow. Yeah. Oh man. Yeah, I'd be interested in knowing, how these guys drum up funding and things like that for their shows. I'm sure it's sponsors involved and whatnot, but definitely an interesting hobby, I think, to have someone come on and talk about.
Oh, absolutely.
All right. Well, let's go over to the new release section here, Joel, and we'll run down this week's big ones. Universal. They like to, I guess, cash in, so to speak, with their movie cash releases, and they put out a bunch with, stuff like Dante's Peak, Jurassic Park. I see that they've put out Waterworld again, and an American Werewolf in London. Good movie. Army of Darkness, another version of Army of Darkness. So, definitely some well-known movies in that lot from Universal, and some that are worth checking out. But we and also Warner's got from their archive collection, they've got Forced Vengeance, which is a Chuck Norris. That's a good one. We also have Tequila Sunrise. There's a Jackie Chan movie called Thunderbolt, Twister, and He Knows You're Alone, which is an interesting addition from their archive collection.
Yeah, that's a nice little novelty because it's the screen debut of Tom Hanks.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure it's a very small role, and if I recall, he does get killed. It is an 80s slasher film, so if you're tired of him talking up the Greatest Generation and you just want some Tom Hanks bloodshed in your life. But
Yeah.
that one is a DVD-R release. Some of Warner's lesser-known releases this week, I'm pretty sure, like Twister is obviously going to be just a straight release, but I think Thunderbolt and Forced Vengeance might also be in their Screen Archives
Yeah.
DVD-R, which is at that point, if it's a film you really love, go for it. But
Yeah, it's from a quality standpoint, if you're like a collector and you're into the quality, you can do better, obviously, but if this is something that it's kind of like to the point where if this is something that you're lacking in your collection and you just need it, then yeah, I guess it would be worth it.
yeah, and the same goes for the Universal releases this week. Like, if you really don't have a copy of Army of Darkness or American Werewolf yet, or Jurassic Park, they're there for you. It's funny though, Army of Darkness I think got released like a year or two ago by Scream Factory. American Werewolf had a release I think just last Halloween when they did all those films with the new sort of avant-garde art covers.
Yeah, that's correct. In fact, RetroMovieNerd.com actually had a giveaway, and that was the winner of the giveaway actually selected that version of An American Werewolf in London.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, pretty cool. I think we'll have another giveaway here very soon. I'll consider it. Unfortunately, employees of RetroMovieNerd.com and Go Home in the Box are ineligible.
Well, that's a deal breaker for me. This podcast is over.
All right then. Well, actually, we've got a few more to talk about here. Let's talk about a couple of Mill Creek releases. One of our favorite distributors. They're putting out a 7-movie collection called Kung Fu Zombies, and it's exactly what you would expect it to be. It's basically a bunch of movies where kung fu meets zombies. We've got Kung Fu Zombie, which is a no-brainer. Kung Fu from Beyond the Grave, Spirited Killer 2 and 3, and a lovely little ditty called "We Are Going to Eat You." And so, it's kind of like if you're a fan of martial arts movies and a fan of zombie movies, this is probably nirvana for you.
And is We're Going to Eat You a fairly recent film, or is that just there happens to be another film with the same title?
Yeah, there's an earlier film from approximately 1980, 81-ish.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a Sweetheart film. All right.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. No, this looks like a pretty great collection. That's a that realm of late 70s, early 80s Hong Kong zombie and vampire films, the really madcap proto Evil Dead, proto Brain Dead, Dead Alive film. It's not really what subgenre I have much of a foot in. That seems like a really good introduction into those kinds of films.
Yeah, generally speaking, they're not considered to be great films, but you know, every genre has its fan, and you know, when you get a mashup of genres like this, I think it's always worth checking out.
Now, one of the things about We're Going to Eat You, and I'm curious about what they're going to do with the music on that one, because the original release, a lot of the soundtrack was lifted from Suspiria.
Yeah, having a few Mill Creek collections of my own, I do know that in some cases music has been cut out and replaced with more, generic, probably public domain stuff. So yeah, I'd be interested to see what's going on with that.
Well, for our wrestling fans in the listening audience, they're probably used to that by this point. So,
Yeah. And also from Mill Creek, we've got a three movie collection, and this one seems pretty kick-ass, Joel. It's the collection is called Payback Time. It includes Blind Fury with Rutger Hauer, Silent Rage with Chuck Norris, and White Line Fever with Jan Michael Vincent.
which, oddly enough, I don't believe was the only truck driving film Jan Michael Vincent starred in.
No, that's right.
I think he was in Convoy. I mean, this was a lot.
He was in Convoy with Chris Christopherson.
I thought he was. I might just be conflating all those.
They are trucker movies.
No, I'm probably thinking of a separate one. I mean, this is all like that post-Truck Turner odd realm of truck movies that I don't know how this genre became so successful for that very brief time.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it was just the accessibility of CB radios mostly at the time. And having to the ability to just the average Joe having the ability to communicate with truckers over their CB radio, and it's just a product of its time. There's a lot of and every era has a fad or something that just has no explanation as to why it became a thing.
Honestly, I would not even know about the existence of the song Convoy if it weren't for The Simpsons. I mean, I can understand Truck Turner, cool movie, Smokey and the
Yeah.
Bandit, cool movie. I mean, it seems like there was sort of a weird undercurrent in the 70s that open road ideal was because it was very much still an element of pop culture. And of course, we had that run of moonshining films.
Oh yeah. And so yeah, I think the 70s definitely it's just a whole different decade that stands out in terms of mysterious tackiness, I guess is the best way I can put it. I don't know. People were still coming down off of all the drugs from the 60s, I guess. And let's see. I like just to touch on Silent Rage. I just watched it recently. Chuck Norris versus. Actually, I think we may have touched on it in our Mad Scientist discussion. Basically, the bad guy in the movie is the product of an experiment where he can't be killed, and bullets don't hurt him.
See,
And so
it's an interesting one.
Yeah, it's kind of like Chuck Norris martial arts meets, I guess, in a way he's kind of a zombie because he can't be killed, but it's definitely a unique film in Chuck's filmography there.
Yeah, it's almost like putting Chuck Norris into a slasher film. He's a very Michael Myers killer.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, it is. Yeah, it's like, I think that's the best way to do it. Chuck Norris in a slasher film.
Just so many films from that era. Something I love. It's just combine two things and see what happens.
Exactly.
Just
Yeah.
very mercenary filmmaking. I adore it.
Yeah, just like Kung Fu Zombies, we got Duff versus Michael Myers. I think it's pretty awesome. Yeah. Shout Factory. They've got a big week this week. They've got a couple of Bruce Lee collector's editions coming out. One is, of course, the iconic Game of Death, and the other being Return of the Dragon, which also includes Chuck Norris. Chuck is big this week. What kind of thoughts do you have? You a Bruce Lee fan there, Joe?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, these are must purchase films. Way of the Dragon is remarkable, or Return of the Dragon, however you want to title, is remarkable for
Right,
having
yeah.
been written and produced and directed by Bruce, his o the only complete directorial film he's ever had. And of course, Game of Death, I mean, is one of the all-time iconic kung
Yeah,
fu films.
that yellow and black striped jumpsuit that he wears, pretty iconic in film. I mean, it inspired Quentin Tarantino for his movie Kill Bill.
Yeah, it's a remarkable film. There's a lot of great scenes and a lot of weirdness surrounding it, of course, because Bruce died while still making it.
Yeah, and so you'll get a mix of his scenes and then the post-production scenes of a stand-in. Shot from behind or whatever the case may be. I think also it was partly responsible for the inspiration towards the old NES video game Kung Fu.
Oh, no doubt, no doubt.
Yeah, because you've got the hero going into the main hideout of the bad guys, and level for level taking out a bad guy in each level until he reaches his ultimate goal.
Oh, definitely.
And
That sort of gauntlet style filmmaking. That's, I mean, there had been films like that in martial arts before, but this was the sort of iconic example of that.
yeah, you've got Bruce Lee versus Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, which was, I'm surprised that was a very effective scene. That was a very good fight between old Bruce and Kareem there.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one of the things about this film is that even the non-Bruce Lee scenes after his death, the action scenes that he didn't direct were directed by Sammo Hung, who was a legendary martial arts actor that, of course, had that sh it had that show on CBS back in the late 90s. I believe Martial Law, was it?
Martial Law, that's right. I was just trying to think of it. Yeah, Sammo Hung and Martial Law. That's right. It's a show.
Yep, and the non-action scenes after Bruce's death were directed by Robert Klaus, the director of Enter the Dragon. So it was completed by people who knew what they were doing. I mean, there are some very strange scenes. I mean, it's pretty infamous for having scenes from Bruce Lee's actual funeral in it.
Oh, wow, yeah. So a couple of Bruce Lee collections from Shout there. And then we'll go to one of my personal favorites, Streets of Fire from 1984. Diane Lane, Michael Paré, Willem Dafoe. Willem Dafoe, one of the first movies I believe seeing Willem Dafoe in. And very good performance. Streets of Fire, basically your rock star gets kidnapped by bad guys, and former Flames happens to be back in town, and he leads the rescue. And very good action movie that combines a lot of action with a lot of good music on the soundtrack as well.
Yeah, this is one I need to see. I know it's a big favorite of yours. It's a Walter Hill film, director of the Warriors. I mean,
Yeah.
soundtrack by Ry Cooder is like just classic guitarist. Great blues musician, country musician, crosses a lot of classic American genres. Great.
Yeah. It's interesting from a production standpoint because it kind of feels like it takes place in the 50s, but it's actually modern. It's kind of got that like the Tim Burton style of production that he did with Batman, where it feels very noirish, but it's at the same time it's also modern. It's quite the excellent production.
Oh, absolutely. And this is one I really need to take a look at very very soon. I mean, you've got Lawrence Gordon and Joel Silver producing, of course, with Walter Hill directing. I think you have three people who I believe were all involved with Tales from the Crypt later on in the 90s.
Yep.
So just a really great pedigree to that film, great cast. And of course, it's a Shout Factory Collector's Edition, so I'm based on what they've done for their... I believe this is probably under the Shout Select line that they've been releasing non-horror cult stuff under, like Buckaroo Banzai, Bill and Ted, based on the work they've done with these. So, I mean, definitely worth checking out just for the quality of the DVD of the Blu-ray package they're putting together and all the bonus stuff.
Yeah, and to top it off, they're putting out a couple of movies with similar themes. We've got Ben and Willard. A couple of movies where the stars are rats.
And these are also collector's editions, so there are a couple of the more elaborate releases from their Scream Factory imprint. Ben, for those, most of our audience might know this factoid, but was the title song Ben by Michael Jackson was his first number one hit as a solo artist.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
And
yeah, it's kind of odd to find it in this movie.
Oh, I know. It just very strange choices being made here. I mean, you know, they're kind of pressing it because that Outcast Gates Revenge theme wasn't quite a mainstream film element at that point. At that point, it would be around 5 years later when Carrie hits, and it becomes a huge trope. But right. You've got a mixture of the Outcast Revenge and Animal Attack elements, which would, of course, you know, a few years later with Jaws, really become a massive subgenre. And you've got major casts. I mean, Willard's got Bruce Davison, Elsa Lanchester, the Bride of Frankenstein herself, Ernest Borgnine. I mean, these are really remarkable, strange films that just... They're odd little films that somehow drew really great people to them and were way more than you'd expect them to be.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, Shout Factory hits it out of the park once again. So probably as far as retro movie distributors, Shout Factory I would probably put at the top of my list. And I generally like to check out whatever it is they put out week to week. And then they generally have some solid releases on a weekly basis.
Oh, absolutely. And I believe there was sort of a late edition this week, because, and not Shout Factory, but I believe Scorpion releasing's Blu-ray of the 1980s slasher film The Silent Scream is going up for pre-order on Monday or Tuesday.
Okay, cool. Yeah.
That one's been pushed back a few times, so... you know, Scorpion sometimes takes a little longer with their discs just because they're a much smaller company than Shout. But it does seem like the pre-orders are going up at their Ronin website this week. So it's definitely something to look into. That's a really affecting atmospheric slasher film with a really great cast. I think Yvonne DiCarlo's in it. Just a really, really interesting little curio in terms of early slashers. It's got Cameron Mitchell and Bruce Steele as well.
All right, Joel. Well, you know, we like to talk about a lot of movies from the VHS era here, and you know, one of the rites of young adulthood. I was going to the video store and looking for, you know, a kick-ass action film or a horror film or whatever the case is. And you would come across a lot of movies with the Canon logo on it. Canon was huge in this era, and they have quite an extensive library, plenty of which... a lot of us have probably seen, and a lot of people in our listening audience, you know, if they're not familiar with Canon, they're about to be, because we're going to talk about the rise and fall of Canon films, and we're going to do a two-part episode. We're going to deal with the rise in this episode. they've kind of got a long, crazy history, and, you know, I mean, they've had documentaries devoted to them, one of which, you know, both you and I have seen, Electric Boogaloo, which is available on Netflix now. Quite an interesting story, providing some backstory to the people behind it. Well, let's touch on the history of canon a little bit, because they kind of go back a little bit to the late 60s. I mean, Canon Films was incorporated in 1967, formed by a couple of guys named Dennis Friedland and Chris Dewey. You know, their first success really was producing English-language versions of Swedish soft porn films, notably something called Inga. And, you know, by around 1970 or so, they started, you know, upping their production scale a little bit, leading to, I guess, probably their first big American hit, a movie called Joe, starring Peter Boyle. And I don't know. Have you seen Joe? Have you seen Joe?
No, I have. You know, I haven't. But Joe is actually pretty representative of a lot of the stuff you're going to see from canon in the future. Even though it's not like a large scale Chuck Norris action film, it is a John Avildsen film, director of Rocky.
Yeah.
Because there's an undercurrent of canon that made it perfect for the 80s. A lot of them are very very reactionary politically, and I'm sure they'd laugh when thinking that there's a political element to their films, but there's a real right-wing independent braced against societal change element in canon, and Joe is such a great way to kick off what we think of as canon films. I mean, it's not quite Death Wish, but it's almost like a little bit Death Wish, a little bit falling down, just an average guy, just absolutely gone over the edge kind of film.
Yeah, and, you know, it stars Peter Boyle, and we know Peter Boyle from Young Frankenstein, and of course on the sitcom Everybody Loves Raymond. You know, Peter Boyle is, if you're familiar with Peter Boyle, then you kind of get some insight into the character of Joe and how that's probably going to turn out.
Oh, absolutely. You know, one of the interesting things was that when he actually attended screenings of Joe, he was so horrified by seeing the audience cheering on the violence. He actually took a break from. He later sort of rescinded refusing to be in violent films, but for many years he avoided them, including turning down the role of Popeye Doyle in French Connection.
Oh yeah. Oh man. I think he would have been perfect for that.
Oh, absolutely. Really, it would have really been a great choice there. But yeah, no, it's just interesting. I'm curious. I'd be curious to really understand more about how he saw the film in terms of where he thought the perception, where he thought the perspective of the film was coming from. I would think he'd view it as a more satirical thing than a lot of the audience did.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Moving on from Joe, you know, the early days of canon with Friedland and Dewey, movies like The Blood on Satan's Claw. So they delved into a horror a little bit here. and then at the same time, you know, still continuing, you know, the softcore porn. But there was a little bit of a mix starting to grow, and so we get like The Blood Ace Claw, and then along comes in 1973 along comes a movie called The No Mercy Man, which I just saw recently. It's available on Amazon Prime Video under the title Train to Kill USA, is the title that I saw it under. But yeah, I mean, I think this was a fan that Quentin Tarantino was a fan of.
Oh yeah, he's. I believe he's played it as part of one of his film programs at the New Beverly. It's a. action revenge film, a little bit of a Western tinge to it. Notable for being one of the first films by legendary cinematographer Dean Koondé. It's also got an early Sid Haig performance in.
Yeah, Sid Haig as a biker named Pillbox. Yeah, it was a pretty good performance from Sid Haig in that movie. Kind of like a low key performance. I would recommend the No Mercy Man to anyone looking for some 70s exploitation to watch. Kind of takes play on the Vietnam vet returning home with post traumatic stress disorder, and then the violence that can occur through that.
Yeah, even if you're not a fan of revenge style films, it's worth it for the just the look of the film. That very stark, like vivid, urgent Dean Koondé look. I mean, this is before he would become really well known with working on John Carpenter stuff, working on Corman stuff. But I mean, it's interesting that the very next year he'd be doing Where the Red Fern Grows right after No Mercy Man.
I guess maybe he needed a break as well. But moving on from the No Mercy Man, early canon, they continued to kind of like branch out a little bit with, titles such as Au Pair Girls, and then following that with Fists of the Double K and Survival of the Dragons. We get to probably another. We're getting into the mid 70s here with like the Happy Hooker, Zebra Force, and then Mako, the Jaws of Death.
One of the earliest Jaws ripoff films, and actually kind of a unique one in that it posits the sharks as fundamentally innocent, just reacting to environmental exploitation. So sort of an interesting take on the killer shark, killer animal phenomenon from the post-Jaws era. Canon really starts branching out by this point. I mean, it's almost anything they can get their hands on. I mean, just going back a little bit, just 72, they did a very strange, they distributed a very strange Italian film, Goodbye Uncle Tom, which was like a Mondo docudrama take on the American South.
Okay.
Really remarkably strange stuff. I mean, they're mostly doing some more traditional exploitation stuff by the mid-70s. I mean, you have your revenge flicks, you have your sexploitation flicks like Happy Hooker, which is actually kind of a weird take on it. It's like, I know it's like sort of biographical, based on a best-selling book. I mean, starring Lynn Redgrave, which is sort of the weird canon films paradox that they get really, really talented people to take on really seedy stuff.
Yeah, yeah. I think that reputation kind of even preceded the years where Menahem Golan and Yoram Globus took over. But just jumping ahead there real quick. So, I mean, yeah, canon, they've always, that reputation preceded them even before they became, big in the distribution business.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they were, and that's the case with any distributor early on in the 70s and 80s. I mean, New Line, pre-Nightmare on Elm Street, whoever you're looking at, most of what they're releasing is just anything they get their hands on that they could conceivably sell. But
yeah,
but Canon, even early on, showed kind of a remarkable talent for getting stuff out there with real talent involved. I mean, not just Z-grade stuff. I mean, even like you talk about, we mentioned one of their first real big film, Inga, which was actually a pretty successful and controversial film in Europe. I mean, ran afoul of censors all over the continent. I'm not sure if any of that happened in America. I mean, the 60s was a weirdly open time for erotic films, I guess you would call them, not quite pornography, but sex-oriented films. I mean, I'm not even sure I would call it sexploitation, because it's almost too serious to be that. I mean, there's that's another boundary that canon often treads on and falls on either side of at any given moment. One of the films, especially in the Golden Globus era, some of the very serious but very seedy sexploitation stuff they'll be taking on.
Right, yeah. And so, you know, basically, you know, as the 70s moved on, you know, they did have some unsuccessful movies in there, and it started to drain their capital, but, you know, before the initial threat of, you know, bankruptcy for, you know, the early stages of the company, they were putting out, and of course, they putting out, like, the sequel to the Happy Hooker, Happy Hooker Goes to Washington. There was Operation Thunderbolt, and another one, probably towards the end of their run, you know, Savage Weekend.
And, you know, Savage Weekend, early slasher film prototype, it's not, I'm trying to think if I've seen this. This is actually on Blu-ray from Kino Lorber. I'm thinking of Death Weekend, I apologize. But early William Sanderson performance, also David Gale from Reanimator, actually decent cast for a very low budget film.
Yeah, yeah. Basically, you know, it's basically a woman retreats to upstate New York with her wealthy boyfriend and a few other friends, and of course we've got a serial killer in their midst. And so yeah, it's just an early slasher film from the Canon Group, towards the end of the end of the beginning, I guess we want to call it, since the initial duo of Dennis Freeland and Chris Dewey hadn't quite sold it yet. But this is where they, right around here, where they hit their financial difficulties, and they sell Canon to Menahem Golan and Yoram Globus, and they only sell it for about $500,000. I think that's kind of a steal.
Oh, definitely. I mean, Grant, I'm not sure the company at that point was really worth much more than that, if that. I mean, they were mostly just distributing at that point. I mean, even one of their bigger hits, Operation Thunderbolt, that was a Golden Globus production, or at least or they may have made it with another a production company rather than their own. But I mean, Menachem Golan actually directed that, and that's a very representative film for what Canon was gonna be. I mean, taking a that's one where they're taking, you know, filmed in Israel. It's actually taking a very serious, very potentially tragic event, you know, a terrorist flight hijacking, and the freeing of Israeli hostages.
Right.
Taking that and making it just like a pure exploitation action film. That's something they would be doing a lot in the 80s, especially with the Chuck Norris films.
Right, yeah. So now we basically hit the Golden Globus era. I mean, they were producing films before Canon, but with the purchase of Canon, they now have their own distribution system. And you know, Menahem Golan, you know, he dabbled in the directing end of things, as well as the production, but, you know, probably his most notorious, we'll call it, directing effort was The Apple.
It is infamous. I mean, it's been considered one of the worst musicals of all time. I wouldn't go that far, because I don't think anything that fascinatingly weird could possibly be one of the worst films of all time. But it's, you know, at some point we're really going to have a show about weird musicals, because in a topic as vast as Canon Films, how do you even begin to explain The Apple?
How do you explain it? I mean, you've got a guy, you know, it's like a rock and roll musical science fiction mishmash of unfinished ideas, and
I mean,
It's got biblical references, and I don't know what's going on here. I mean, we've got a guy showing up in the sky in a Rolls Royce named Mr. Tops, and
Mr. Tops is
and the rapture occurs, and everyone gets taken to heaven or wherever they're going in the Rolls Royce.
So for those of our listeners who are unfamiliar with the Apple, which I'm assuming is almost everyone, this was going to be Menachem Golang's Tommy. He is not Ken Russell. And of course, this was all original music made for the film. I mean, it's, you know, vast biblical metaphors. I mean, there's an evil 1984-ish corporation. It was actually going to be set in 1984 before they realized that wasn't far enough into the future. So it's set in the futuristic year of 1994.
Oh, 1994 is the future.
Like, this was what they thought rock and roll was going to be in 1994. The year Kurt Cobain dies, it was going to be glam disco rock. I mean, the absolute opposite of what was going on in music at the time. Also, notably, there is a major black actress among the supporting players who starts out as one of the major stars for the evil corporation BIM, and I love that they're named BIM, but there's a distinct lack of black musical influence in this movie.
Yeah.
And there's hippies who don't look anything like the hippies you would expect or you might see in, say, the Woodstock documentary from 69. Just nothing. Canon Films has a weird relationship with youth culture in terms of how accurate and inaccurate they could possibly be.
Yep.
And the Apple is more on the inaccurate side.
We're gonna hit on a couple of more,
including one that I know we're gonna be talking about that's actually remarkably on the pulse of things when it was released. But the Apple certainly not. I mean, it's a glam film about hippies after glam rock died, after hippies were gone. It's the 80s, you know, no punk rock in. No new wave, nothing that might be relatable in 1980, and most of the cast. I mean, there were some professional singers in the cast. I mean, Grace Kennedy's in there. I think the main actress is Catherine Mary Stewart, who our audience might know from the lead role of Night of the Comet. I believe they overdubbed her for this one.
Yes, they did. Apparently, she had issues with the vocals, and I believe they did overdub her voice during the singing scenes.
Yeah, this, you know, it's really hard to accurately explain how strange this film is.
basically, you know, in order to portray how strange this film is, I think we just need to have people go out and see it.
There is in June a Blu-ray coming out from Scorpion Releasing, I believe.
Yeah,
it's going to be fantastic.
Yeah,
I've got mine on pre-order.
Yeah, definitely. So we can talk about it all we want, but in the end, it's something that just needs to be seen to be believed.
And with everything we've got covered today, it's one that almost definitely needs to be covered in a very separate episode.
Yeah. Of course, Golan and Globus, you know, they're actually family. They're related. They're cousins, and so they ended up, I guess, forging a business model of where they would buy these really bad scripts and just put them into production, and so. I want to give a shout out. Around this time, 1980-ish, I want to mention a movie that I saw recently called Last Rites, or it's actually also known as Dracula's Last Rites. It's a very regional, low-budget horror film, and I caught it on Amazon Prime Video, and not one of those films where you could the sets, you could see the pipe work on the ceiling. you could see equipment on the stairs in some scenes where the actors would have to step over the actual equipment. And not a good movie, but it just had a charm all on its own, just because it was so, it's so bad it's good. And it's got the best dummy flying through a window scene that I've ever seen.
I don't know, does it compare to the end of Nightmare on Elm Street?
I think it holds up. Yes, I do. I'll take that to my grave. Yes.
Yeah, you know, Canon's an interesting place around here because in 1980 is fairly busy for them. They released a lot of stuff, including a lot of horror films, some of which Shout Factory put out, like The Godsend and Schizoid, and also New Year's Evil, which I'm not sure has gotten a proper DVD or Blu-ray. Oh, you know, I think they did put out New Year's Evil, Scream Factory did. But there's a huge break in 1981 until one of their biggest films comes out in October. So they go from December of 1980 to October 81 without releasing anything. And I can only assume that's because they were trying to actually, unlike Canon typically, they were actually trying to put a plan together to make money after losing so much on the Apple.
Exactly. Yeah. And boy, did they lose money on the Apple. But anyway, I believe you're referring to Enter the Ninja?
The legendary Enter the Ninja.
I knew it. I love Enter the Ninja.
I mean, just
Menachem Golan, you know, wanting to do a ninja movie. I can imagine the conversations he had in the boardroom with his Yoram about, what he thought a ninja actually was.
And, you know, this was the film that I think more than anything really introduced most American audiences to the concept of ninjas. I mean, there was always a little bit of that found in pop culture. We've always kind of had a fascination with Japanese mythology, with Japanese feudal history, just partly because they were the one country that never was really conquered during the colonial era. And yeah. But, you know, for years and years, it was mostly samurai movies. Ninjas were not as common, I think, just because it was easier to transpose the samurai motif onto knights or onto, you know, cowboys, whatever. Yeah, whatever you want to choose. Enter the Ninja, doing brilliant and making its main ninja Franco Nero, Django himself.
And I was about to say, and who do you call when you need a ninja? You call Franco Nero.
Franco Nero, remarkably, a very poorly dubbed Franco Nero.
Yeah, so see, they were, I guess they were trying to, like you say, come up with a plan, and I guess there was a market for these action B movies, and Enter the Ninja was a good start for them.
Yeah, I mean, they really put together something oddly special. I mean, Golan, of course, directed this. I mean, you know, Shokosugi, who would be who's a martial arts mainstay and a ninja film mainstay, is involved, and of course, would be in later Canon films. Susan and Christopher George are here. It's just kind of, just a really interesting way to introduce a concept to America that people might not be as familiar with. I mean, the ninja movie, ninjas, not just as movies, I mean, became a just giant trope in the 80s. You go from ninja movies to Snake Eyes and G.I. Joe to Ninja Turtles. I mean, they just stick in pop culture. Canon has a lot of pop cultural influence even today, but you know, the ninja might be their biggest contribution.
Yeah, and of course, since we're talking about Enter the Ninja, we have to go through the triumvirate there, Joel. So we have to include Revenge of the Ninja from 1983. It had Sho Kosugi actually starring. And from Revenge of the Revenge of the Ninja to Ninja 3: The Domination in 1984, and how did they describe it? ninja movie meets
Exorcist meets Flashdance.
Meets Flashdance, yeah.
It started with Shota Sugi and Lucinda Dickey, who was like, who was Tanning's very much, you know, go-to actress for a lot of films, including the Breaking films, which we'll get to in a bit. But the best of these, I would actually say, is Revenge of the Ninja. The stuff starring Show, I think, is always a little bit better than any other ninja stuff.
Right.
Just because
he just lends credence, just because it's, you know, is that it's an actual Asian guy playing a ninja, you know,
and
compared
yeah.
to Franco Nero and Lucinda Dickey.
And you know, he's an actual martial artist. He can do stunts. He's an actual martial arts champion. I mean, he's a high level martial artist. This is a guy who just physically just lends credibility to any action scene he's filmed in. But, you know, Revenge of the Ninja, I think, is legitimately, like, good action film, and so is Iron the Ninja. But Ninja 3 is something really special. I mean, I know this is sounding almost repetitive after we've discussed the Apple, but this is just, it's just hard to explain. It's hard to explain how strange some of this is. Not the actual concept. I mean, it's out there, but you know, just someone being possessed by the vengeful spirit of a ninja, like, that happens to us every day. That's, you know, watch the news. But
yeah,
that's not in a post Exorcist, you know, post Rosemary's Baby, possession plots are not wildly unexpected in a B movie, but there's just so many odd, unique, weird touches and scenes in this film. It's not as overwhelmingly everything as weird as the Apple. I think my best comparison is probably The Happening. Like, The Happening, bad movie, fascinating movie. It's not so, like, the main plot, it's just sort of a modernized take on environmental revenge films from the 70s. It's not that unprecedented, but just the way it's done and the choices made are so strange that you have to wonder how it happened. And Ninja 3 is like that. It's not necessarily cursed from birth like the Apple was. Ninja 3 is just, it went to strange places.
Yeah, absolutely it did. Yeah, so, you know, we talk about recommending The Apple. It's one of those movies you have to actually see it to believe everything that people say about it. Ninja 3 is the same way. You can listen to people talk about it all day long, but in the end, you just have to visualize it by watching it. It's just off the wall. Of course, they're not even done with the ninja movies at this point, because then they decide to, Americanize it by bringing in Michael Dudikoff as American Ninja.
they really stretched themselves in the title, of course. And American Ninja has an interesting little story in that it was intended to be a Chuck Norris film, but you know, Chuck at that point being one of their main box office draws, but he refused to do a film where he'd have to wear a mask so much. Apparently, Chuck Norris's vanity is pronounced.
Yes, and but you know, Michael Dudikoff was up to the task. I mean, I don't know if it was charisma that he had, because I've seen American Ninja 2, The Confrontation, and I don't necessarily think Dudikoff was like a charismatic actor.
I think it
but I mean, I believed him. I believe that he actually was a ninja. I mean, he did catch those poison darts in midair with his bare hands, you know?
I think it might just be a mixture of having a good action hero look and just a basic likability. And, like, he just obviously took the thing seriously. And
yes, he did. That's what I wanted to say. Yes, it was on the tip of my tongue. He looked like he actually believed he was a ninja.
Yeah, no, this is a... Which... It's one of those weirdly endearing things, because You know, so many canon films are basically the stories you'd make up with your friends when playing in the backyard. It, like, so watching Michael Dudikoff really convince himself he's a ninja over the course of this is basically what you did as a kid, where you're so into the stupid game you're playing that by the end of it, you're surprised you're not a ninja.
and of course, you know, that's basically helped Dudikoff take off to be one of the bigger B and C movie stars of the VHS, the direct-to-video era, well into the 90s even. So he got some good mileage out of it.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, dude's still working today. He just did Navy SEALs versus Zombies, which don't know if that's actually a sequel to the original Navy SEALs, but I'm hoping it is.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the pro wrestling only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero here, and I want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com, and we now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with Clotheslines and Headlines, Main Event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows. And we leave wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse, the Our Vantage Point podcast, which features a potpourri-style look at wrestling history, and Survey Says, a fun look back at the good, bad, and ugly of WCW. And on our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast, Our Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversations, Geek and Sassy, and the Imaginary Stories. You can find all these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All these shows plus others available at PlayStation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlayStation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, thehistoryofwrestling.com, and Scott Keith's blog, Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlayStation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. Subscribe on iTunes or on Android with your favorite podcast app. Established in 2013, the Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network is committed to providing unique takes on the rich and diverse medium of professional wrestling, focusing on its history and global impact, but also exploring the vibrant contemporary scene. The roll call includes Space City, an NWA On Demand podcast, This Week in Wrestling, Stacey and Elliott's Bogus Journey, the Super Apoitas podcast, The Military Industrial Suplex, Strong Style History, Puro Puri, and Psychology is Dead. Also, from the archives, the full catalog of great shows that provided a fresh look at classic wrestling, including Where the Big Boys Play, Titans of Wrestling, Tag Teams Back Again, Letters from Kayfabe, Wrestling Culture, Pro Wrestling Super Show, Goodwill Wrestling, and many, many others. Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. Only the best.
The Death Wish sequels begin with canon. So you've got Death Wish 2, which was probably, I guess, the more grittier, I don't want to say realistic, but it was more along the lines of what the first one was. But then Death Wish 3 comes along and just and just totally blows it all away.
And Death Wish 3 is just, oh, phenomenal. See, here's the thing. One of the interesting things is they somehow managed to get Michael Winner, the director of the original, to push back for these. And Michael Winner is like an exploitation director among exploitation directors. He is very much – he's made approximately two films, I think – actually probably three, I think, are genuinely great, all of which have Bronson. I mean, he made Chato's Land, The Mechanic, and the original Death Wish.
Right, yeah.
But he's a guy who really courts controversy. I mean, Death Wish, of course, was a remarkably controversial film. There's a 67 British film he did called I'll Never Forget What's-His-Name with Oliver Reed and Orson Welles, right. Which was actually possibly the first mainstream film to use the word fuck. And actually... one of the first instances, I believe, of implied oral sex in a mainstream film.
Wow, yeah.
I mean, he is a director, a really conservative director, a Thatcher supporter, and Death Wish it's impossible to talk about like we did on the, in our revenge film episode. It's impossible to talk about Death Wish and not talk about the political landscape surrounding it because it was such a flashpoint for public discussion.
Yeah, in some circles it was reviled because of its pro-gun message.
Of course, we talked about how the novels themselves were not pro-gun. Death Wish 2 is Death Wish up to 11. It's the same as Death Wish. It's just darker, it's more violent, it's more tragic, and frankly, it's dumber.
Yeah, and then Death Wish 3 becomes over-the-top, cartoony, just sheer awesome, just crazy bullshit.
I mean, once you see that trailer with Chuck, like, lugging around that, like, 50 caliber, like, proto-Jesse the Body in Predator, it's just...
Yeah, I love that. He's got that big, huge gun. He's taking out guys, but he's got this guy standing next to him holding the box. The guy's got to follow him around with the box of bullets. It's a thing of beauty.
It really is. And Death Wish 3, there's unfortunate implications all over the place. And, of course, the film tries to hedge its bets by saying, oh, sure, we're killing all these multicultural gang members, but we're protecting all these multicultural apartment building residents. we're protecting this elderly Jewish couple. We're protecting the young, like, Latino couple. Like,
that's right.
We're just giving you a lot of scenes where we're shooting Latino gang members. And yeah. The word for canon films a lot of the time I'm going to end up using is reactionary, because when you get to the action, I mean, these are pure Reagan era action films.
Yeah. And of course, Death Wish 3 comes at the peak of canon. They were really hitting their stride there in the action film market, making money hand over fist, putting out, 20, 30, 40 films a year. But of course, as you mentioned, not just Charles Bronson, but another one of their top stars at the time was Chuck Norris. And you've got movies like The Delta Force, which also had Lee Marvin, and you've got Invasion USA. Now, the trailer for Invasion USA, we talk about Death Wish 3, being something cartoony. Invasion USA, basically, you've got foreigners coming ashore in boats, jumping into waiting vehicles, headed for different parts of the country to systematically, take over, and you've only got one man standing against them, and that's Chuck Norris.
Predating Red Dawn, even, in terms of inexplicable attacks on American soil. Yeah, the interesting thing about canon is that, and this might just be because you had a copy run by two Israeli nationals, a lot of these films, much more than even a lot of other 80s action films that were actively dealing with terrorist threats.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a very strange thing, especially, you know, at the point in history we're at. Like, the complete exploitation of terrorism for, you know, your good time action hijinks, basically. I mean, Invasion USA is fantastic. I mean, Joe Zito is directing, of course, director of Friday 13th, 4, The Prowler, Red Scorpion. Just classic genre director. It's, you know, it's also, in a weird way, I think it sort of presages the downfall of canon films, because this is a bigger film than they were used to, and they got very lucky filming it. One of the amazing anecdotes about it is that they actually managed to get hold, basically, of a neighborhood that was being steamrolled to increase the length of a nearby major airport.
Yeah.
So they were actually able to blow up real houses.
That's right. They actually managed to talk themselves into using these soon-to-be-destroyed properties to blow them up for Invasion USA.
So they basically got to do a much bigger film on a smaller budget than a film like that would have cost. I don't think they ever, like, learned their lesson about that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that was their style, though. You know, go big or go home, basically, at this point in time. We're talking early to mid-80s here. And we know that Menachem Golan was, you know, the idea guy, Yoram Globus being the money man, basically, behind everything, you know, the salesman. The thing about Golan and Globus, wasn't it they would just, like, create, in order to get financing for these movies, wouldn't they just, like, create the poster of their idea and then sell it just based on a poster for something that didn't exist yet?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, classic technique. I mean, I'm not sure if they were the first to do that. I'm sure on some level Corman did that at various points. I know Empire Pictures and later Full Moon would, of course, use that. Yeah, there's a line in The Apple about BIM, the evil record company that runs the world, that first you sell the album and then you make it. And it's funny that Golan wrote the evil 1984 record company to have the same business practices as himself.
Yeah, that was like an interesting, you know, little side trip for them there, just, you know, to get investors. They would just sell the movie before it was even made. And like I said, Menachem especially always thought big when it came to the action movies, but I imagine they wanted to vary the output a little bit, and so they'd branch into, you know, comedies. You know, we had the Last American Virgin, and like period movies like Lady Chatterley's Lover, Bolero, Mata Hari.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's fascinating because canon, despite the fact that especially now we think of them as the kings of 80s action films. I mean, they. Yeah, of course, in keeping with their style of fundraising and keeping with their style of filmmaking, you know, basically approached everything they could that could conceivably make them money. And they also were very much – see, canon almost operates as a perpetual motion machine. If you just keep moving, you'll never have to stop.
Like, right, yeah.
And so – basically, they took on any project that had someone attached that they might know that had something they could potentially. Yeah, you know, there are so many facets to canon that just absolutely fascinate me. Like, they want respect, so they work with real. They work with, you know, big names on period pieces. I mean, you know, the Wicked Lady with Faye Dunaway, also another Michael Winner film. You know, which remade a classic. Golden Age of Hollywood adventure film, but it's you know, there's a, you know, two woman whip fight where people, where woman's clothing
aren't
is
they
getting,
both topless?
Yeah, now I think there's a topless sword fighting scene in that. I think the clothes are just getting torn periodically over the course of the whip battle. Like, I mean, Lee Charlie's lover, they basically took it on because there was a chance for like tons of sex scenes. I mean, they never totally got away from their Swedish erotica like background. They Bolero, nothing but sex scenes. Like, these are all films that theoretically could have given them some level of credibility, and
they would just sleaze it up with boobs.
Yeah, and I mean, Bolero was kind of a vanity project anyway, and definitely won big at the Razzies that year. But I mean, something like Wicked Lady, even like a post Mommy Dearest Faye Dunaway, and like, you know, Michael Winner directing, remake of a classic film, like, you know, John Gielgud was in that. That actually could have been like a legitimate film. And of course, Michael Winner. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, I was just going to say, yeah, but they would just sabotage it for themselves.
Yeah, and you know, Michael Winner is almost aside from Golan, the perfect Cannes director, because he's someone who could be better than he is, but seems almost compulsively addicted to being sleazy to provoke a reaction, and also very compulsively, this isn't even compulsive, it's just neglectful. I mean, he treated his actors horribly.
Yeah, no, not a lot of people have a good thing to say about Winner, but
I mean, he's not quite Lars von Trier, but he's definitely on that spectrum. Just that weird schizophrenia in canon films. I mean, Last American Virgin is an awesome example because it does some stuff that's actually surprisingly different for an 80s teen movie. And, you know, it's weird enough that it's a remake of an Israeli teen movie, Lemon Popsicle, and the same director just doing it for an American audience.
Yep.
But, you know, it's, of course, got a big name soundtrack. I mean, Gary actually did music for this, but of course Blondie's on the soundtrack. You know, U2, Journey, The Police, REO Speedwagon, The Commodores, The Cars, Devo, Quincy Jones. I mean, that is just like, that's, oh my God.
That's big time.
That's huge people on that soundtrack. It amazes me they still can put that out because music rights really I think they just did a Blu-ray of that a couple years ago. I mean, music rights can really, make releasing films difficult. You know, it's just kind of it's a remarkable film because there are genuinely serious scenes, like, I mean, that are also undermined. I mean, like, there's a full abortion plot. There's an unhappy ending where the guy doesn't get the girl. I mean, I'm sorry to spoil it, but
I'm sure a lot of people have seen The Last American Virgin. I mean, but yeah, that's a heartbreaker of an ending, man. I can't watch that movie again.
Oh yeah, no, I mean, it's and at the same time, like, you know, there's tasteless jokes. The abortion scene gets cut straight into a pizza cutting scene. There's YouTube playing over an abortion. Like, there's sex antics, sex comedy antics that you would almost want to describe as Porky's-esque, but they seem so, like, these high school kids are like going to prostitutes. Like, I'm sure this is something that happens in like other countries. And of course, the original Lemon Popsicle was set in the 50s, which I'm assuming was the director's, you know, teen years, or at least around his coming of age. And I'm sure, like, in the 1950s. Like, that might have been a more common thing just to go to a prostitute, but like in the early 80s, even before AIDS is really a known quantity, I don't know, just the idea of like your average teenager going to a prostitute rather than just like trying to get laid with like one of his classmates, it just seems like something that I'm not sure happened often.
Yeah, I can't recall. I don't know. I could have been blacked out, but I can't recall ever needing to go to a prostitute.
It's just really, I mean, they catch crabs from the prostitute. This is really weird. This is really weird stuff. And it's, obviously, even in some of the you know, more risque Porky's kind of teen comedies for the era. It's not really stuff that happens.
Well, you know, since they're branching into the comedy realm here, we have to get into you know, probably one of their more well-known, you know, lighter fare. I guess we call it a comedy, but it's also somewhat of a musical as well. Of course, we're getting into the Breakin' series of movies, Breakin', and then its sequel, Breakin' 2, Electric Boogaloo.
And you know, we've sort of been leading up to this because Breakin' is, I think, the one time where they really managed to actually have their finger on the pulse of something new. Like, yeah. I mean, you've got actual legitimate street dancers, hip hop, break dancers. You've got Ice-T showing up, a very young Ice-T. You know, it's funny how much the dancing films of the 1980s really stuck with us. I think that's partly because, like, you know, there's a ton of, like, music films, a ton of rock and roll films, but it's easy to fake those. Like, you know, you can just, like, find an attractive dude, put a leather jacket on him, give him a guitar, and just, like, pretend he's a rock star. With, you know, something like Breakin' or even, like, Dirty Dancing, Flashdance, any of that stuff, like, you actually need to find dancers. And especially for something like Breakin', which is about a very specific niche type of dancing that wasn't really practiced by most professional dancers of the era. I mean, this was all still street-level stuff. Like, then you've got to find people who are actually part of the scene, and that lends it like a veracity and authenticity that you can't really fake at that point.
Right, and then of course they go and they put Lucinda Dickey in the movie, and I understand that there was a little bit of animosity, I believe, towards her from the rest of the cast because she didn't really, I guess, fit in or match up to you know, the rest of the cast for the most part.
Yeah, and that's one of those, like, happy accidents, because she was actually a trained dancer, just trained in more traditional types of dance. So, you know, the whole plot of the film is basically what she was going through on set. She's trying to dance in this style.
Yeah.
So you've got something that actually, like, doesn't feel... It's so easy to make a teen-oriented film that feels pandering and phony. Like, I mean, they're, like, Last American Virgin. There's stuff that is very real, and there's stuff in there that is just completely alien to any teenage experience I've ever heard of. And
yeah.
Breakin', you know, this was the film that this was the last canon film that MGM released. Their distribution deal got screwed up. I think they resolved it partly because Bolero was very close to being X-rated.
Yeah, and it didn't help that, you know, they were really putting out some... a lot of junk, or what MGM considered to be junk.
Oh, yeah, they were... I mean, MGM did not have a high opinion of them. They were putting out a lot of genuine... I mean, not just crap in the sense that we lovingly talk about bad films. I mean, stuff that is potentially unreleasable.
Yeah. It's kind of... well, MGM, of course, has been around since, you know, the pre-code Hollywood days, you know, as a film studio, and so I guess there was a bit of high and mighty mucky muck kind of attitude from them. I mean, they're never associated with canon, who, you know, even before their deal with MGM, they were kind of lowbrow.
Oh yeah, I mean, I think the thing is, it was just a remarkable storm of really unfortunate situations. I mean, when you look at the stuff that MGM actually released of canons, there's a lot of stuff that would be very attractive to MGM. I mean, even stuff like 10 to Midnight, which is a Charlie Bronson crime thriller.
Yeah.
All right, pretty traditional. Revenge of a Ninja, not really an MGM thing, but, you know, a pretty respectable, straightforward action film. But Wicked Lady, you'd think that MGM, looking at, like, an Oscar-winning actress in a remake of a classic film, they would be attracted to that. Hercules, I mean, it's Lou Ferrigno being in a classic sword and sorcery style thing that ends up much weirder than they'd ever imagine. I mean, you'd think post like Clash of the Titans, this would be potentially a winner, but the special effects are bad even by canon standards.
They're bad. I love the scene of Hercules tying a rope around a rock and lassoing it into the air to, you know, help, you know, jumpstart his chariot into space.
Oh my god, he throws a bear into space. This is a perfect film.
He fights a bear and he knocks the bear into outer space. Oh my goodness, you know, but we call these movies awesome, but we mean it in a tongue-in-cheek sense. But I mean, the Hercules is another one of those movies that you just have to you have to sit down and watch it and just appreciate it for what it is.
Oh yeah, I mean you've got like films that would theoretically be attractive. Like Hercules seemed like a potential winner based on it's the Incredible Hulk playing a mythological character in a sword and sorcery epic after Clash of Titans.
Yeah,
you know, you've got Sahara, which seemed like a good idea post Raiders and Romancing the Stone. I mean, it was going to be a big adventure film.
But it had Brooke Shields.
Brooke Shields. Oh, in a terrible role. I mean, this was a film they had enough trust in. Like, Ennio Morricone does the score. Yeah. I mean, this was theoretically going to be a big film.
Yeah. And then...
None of the stuff, like...
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Even something like Over the Brooklyn Bridge, which was... You know, it probably seemed like which Golan directed. It's, you know, a romantic comedy about Elliot Gould. Elliot Gould is a Jewish man who falls in love with a non-Jewish woman. So that seemed like the kind of observant but lighthearted romantic comedy. So it's sort of like I could see them thinking it was going to be like their Moscow on the Hudson.
Yeah. But you know, financially they just weren't there, and I guess maybe that was part of MGM's, disgust, so to speak, with canon, was that a lot of these movies just bombed.
Yeah, I mean, a company like MGM, would like keep canon. It's like Paramount with the Friday the 13th films; they were embarrassed by them, but they kept them. They only sold them to New Line after they stopped being profitable.
Yeah.
So, MGM, I'm sure, was happy to work with Canon as long as they were conceivably a profitable venture. And I'm actually kind of surprised Breakin did not sort of resurrect that relationship. I think Bolero totally destroyed it.
Oh yeah, Bolero was bad financially, critically, just. Morally. So I mean, this is one of the worst movies of all time, you know. When you're going to make a list of them, Bolero is going to be high up. Speaking of that, you know, back to the action side of things a little bit, they did have a huge hit with Missing in Action starring Chuck Norris. I mean, some people thought maybe it was a cash-in on the Rambo series, or kind of preemptive, because I think Rambo First Blood Part 2, I think, came out in 85. But this is them, you know, jumping in on that, you know, the Vietnam War action pick, you know, the 80s was rife with them. And Missing in Action was one of the leading... You know, was one of the ones that kicked in the door for this genre.
Oh, definitely. A funny thing about that is that one of the story treatments for Rambo First Blood 2 was actually going around in Hollywood at the time because James Cameron wrote it, and it took them sort of an unexpectedly long time to make. I would assume that was partly due to Stallone's busy schedule, but so. They were very much aware of the direction Rambo was going in, and it's thought that they were very much inspired by that in making the Missing in Action films. But it's hard to tell because so much of the Missing in Action series in terms of production is strange. I mean, the first one, which is, of course, Joe Zito was not going to be the first one.
No, that's right. It was going to be the sequel.
But the sequel was apparently so poorly thought of at Canon, they weren't sure how to release it. And Joe Zito actually went to them and said he would make a missing in action film that you could sell, which would then help them sell the second one.
So, yeah, I mean, actually, the prequel, Missing in Action 2, the beginning, was actually supposed to be the first one.
And it's a very different film. It's a much more somber film. It's very much, it's that Canon schizophrenia again, trying to be serious and being as sleazy as possible while doing it.
Yeah, yeah. So basically they realized that the planned second movie was, better than the first one. So, it came kind of like it was just awkward.
It's a strange film. The first one, Joe Zito Missing in Action, is just exactly what you'd want out of that film. It's just a big, dumb, loud, fun, stupid action film that totally glosses over any political context you could possibly have for it. Just you don't have to think. You just get dragged along with it. Missing in Action 2 is, again, Missing in Action, the beginning, is trying to be the serious, like, this is what it was like in the war kind of film. It just feels that weird mix of patronizing and very lowbrow.
Yeah. You know what? I want to touch on this real quick because there's one movie that they seem to get right on all ends of things, critically, financially, even from an award standpoint. And we're talking about Runaway Train with John Voight and Eric Roberts. Just an excellent movie all around. And this is one of their rare, actual good movies.
And, I haven't seen this yet, but, like, everything I've seen about this seems really promising. I mean, actual acting nominations in a Canon film for John Voight and Eric Roberts. I mean, yep. It's a weird sort of throwback to the sort of classic Hollywood era of adventure films where you could do a big adventure film that was still really quality with good characters. I mean, original screenplay was by Kurosawa, actually.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah,
Directed by Andrei Konchalovsky, who is most known for Tango and Cash, and also known in my circle for The Nutcracker in 3D.
Yeah,
which is that's a remarkably bad film that we may have to talk. We may have to do an episode at some point about terrible children's films because that is a winner. Runaway Train is, again, this is one of the few Canon films I haven't really seen, but the renown this film has is just amazing. This may be also one of the reasons Canon would, in the future, along with Asian USA, one of the reasons they would try to do bigger films.
Yeah, just all the accolades it gets are actually well-deserved. It's just a nice, taut, action-filled suspense thriller, and it kind of reminded me of a movie from the 70s, Emperor of the North, with Ernest Borgnine and Lee Marvin, but this one's a little bit different. But yeah, I mean, if you haven't seen it, I recommend checking it out. It's a great movie, one of Canon's rare hits that actually deserved all the accolades it received.
Yeah, just the fascinating. The sad thing is, it's an oddity. Like, it's just a complete footnote in the Canon lineup. Not in terms of like the actual respect people have for it, but in terms of the effect on the rest of Canon films.
Yeah, and this again is at the peak, Canon's peak, in terms of financial gain here. You know, this came out in 1985, which is also the year of, you know, some of their stuff, like their remake of King Solomon's Mines with Richard Chamberlain and Sharon Stone.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, and they actually put out a sequel to Hercules called The Adventures of Hercules. That came out in 1985. There was also Life Force, which I just saw this past weekend, which is just my term for a movie like Life Force is just batshit insane.
I am a huge Life Force fan. A lot of people are very torn on Life Force. Uh-huh. I understand it, but I think the film does so much interesting stuff. The atmosphere is so singular. The special effects are just fantastic. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a film that I totally understand why people might not like it, or why they're just not sure how to take it.
Yeah, and I understand that too. I mean, just seeing that the story is kind of all over the place and incorporates elements from different genres. I mean, you've got it incorporates some elements from Alien, and then it incorporates elements from your typical vampire film, and then out of nowhere suddenly it becomes about the end of the world. and there's a lot of crazy and special effects in it, and an ending which I thought was quite abrupt as well. I mean, the movie suddenly was over. You're like, what? Wait.
it's a very strange, and what fascinates me, aside from just the mood, is so odd. And so, you know, it's one of those rare sort of end of the world horror films that it sort of achieves its mood by being bigger than it has any right to be. I mean, in terms, they accomplish so much with so little in that film. I think the closest comparison I have is The Beyond.
Yes, okay, yeah.
Or at least in the final acts of both films have that sort of inescapable feeling to them.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And like we were saying, I can understand where someone may not like that movie because it's kind of all over the place. But then again, you know, it's for that very same reason, it's a guilty pleasure movie for a lot of people as well.
Yeah, and just a weirdly fascinating film. I mean, there's this whole, like, psychic soul energy transference element to it that is just not something you see in terms of, because it's so difficult to explain what the hell they're doing in American films. Honestly, if you had told me Life Force was based on like one of the weirder 70s or 80s anime films, like something like Space Runaway Ideon, or, you know, any of those proto Evangelion films, now I think these sentences are as strange as this film itself. If you had told me that it was based on a weird anime series that was completely untranslatable, I would believe you.
Yeah. So Life Force was another big one. Well, actually, you know, it was supposed to be a big one. It turned out to be a financial flop for them, probably because a lot of people couldn't, you know, get a grip on what type of movie this was supposed to be. But again, Canon can do no wrong at this point. They're churning out movies left and right. We'll move into 1986 here, probably their peak. And 1986 saw them put out, you know, the Delta Force, which we mentioned earlier, which was a big one for them. The Highlander, which is another pretty good film that started a franchise. There's America 3000. I reviewed that movie. My movie, RetroMovieNerd.com, used to be known as BMovieMemories.com, and America 3000 was one of the first movies I reviewed for it.
Oh, my condolences. How did you keep going after that?
Grit and determination, young man. There was also Murphy's Law, another Charles Bronson action flick. They keep they managed to keep roping Charles Bronson into these Paul Kersey-esque roles. You know, you mentioned, you know, of course the Death Wish films, but you mentioned 10 to Midnight and then Murphy's Law. I mean, Charles Bronson at this point in his career probably, I believe he wanted to take on something different, but he kept coming back to, you know, the stoic action figure role. Murphy's Law would be included in that. And
they kept banging him.
Yeah. And also Cobra, another personal favorite movie of mine, Cobra with Sylvester Stallone. Yeah, I mean, this is a great one.
Yeah, and Cobra sort of goes with Highlander and Life Force in that these are bigger films with bigger budgets that Canon isn't releasing alone. I mean, Cobra, Warner Brothers was involved with Highlander, you know, 20th Century Fox, and, you know, Life Force had TriStar involved. So they're putting out bigger films, but they're still kind of hedged against it because there's other companies' money involved with these.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, as an aside, you know, Cobra, once again, I think what we should do, Joel, is invest in an abandoned warehouse, but keep the furnaces running. Because those are good grounds for good guy bad guy duels at the end of a film, and I think Cobra falls in line with that. There's always an abandoned warehouse or something where there's still a furnace ablaze and you know stuff being worked on, and I don't know.
If I learned anything from 80s action films, it's that the reason we were losing our manufacturing to the Japanese at the time was that all of our warehouses, all of our production plants, all of our steel mills, they were just full of people shooting at each other.
They were just getting blown to shit. Yeah. Yeah, let's see, 1986. We also got Invaders from Mars and Haunted Honeymoon with Gene Wilder and Gilda Radner. That was a good one. And then they took a little foray into anime there with Robotech the Movie.
It's also one of the weird examples of Canon kind of being ahead of their time. I mean, Robotech, you know, was a kind of a mainstay on TV at the time in syndication because it was just like cheap to put together from a couple different Japanese TV shows, Macross, a couple other ones, and Canon distributed. I have to wonder if that was maybe inspired by the release of Transformers, the movie, like they wanted to rush out a big robot film.
Yeah, that seems like a measure that Canon would take, you know, wanting to jump in on a trend.
I mean, my God, I'm surprised they didn't manage to get some kind of cut of the toy rights.
Yeah. Then you know, they got in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2. Is also on this list.
Yeah, and yeah, this is a weird, busy period for Toby Hooper. I would have to. I don't know what.
Yeah,
his,
he did this right after Life Force. Yeah.
And Invaders from Mars, that was his too, the remake of an absolute classic. So I don't know if this was after his drug period, which I know sort of culminated in Poltergeist and the very obscured making of that film where no one really knows how much of it was Spielberg and how much of it was Hooper.
Right, yeah.
But Toby seemed very busy at this point. I don't know if he's on the wagon finally, but it does seem like Ken gave his career new life. I mean, he was not financially successful with them, at least for Life Force and Invaders from Mars. I don't know if Texas Chainsaw 2 did well. I think it did, and it's probably just purely the best film of the three.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, I enjoyed it myself. So, yeah, Invaders from Mars not so much, and Life Force. I'm still trying to make my mind up about that one. But
I think most people have that reaction.
They still are. They're still 30 years later. They're still trying to figure out Life Force. Man, what the hell did I just watch? And it's like 30 years later. Oh man. Anyway, so yeah, 1986 definitely probably when Canon peaked. I mean, I've seen some reports where they put out 43 movies that year. I mean, wow.
Oh, it's so amazing. I mean, they have a film. They released Hell Squad on January 1st, which is I haven't seen it, but it looks like one of those very Andy Sedaris, Ted Mikkels kind of Charlie's Angels-ish film. So naturally, I want to see it like tomorrow.
Yeah.
December 31st, they released a film called Ursa, which, God, I don't even know what this is.
That looks like maybe a Russian film of some kind. I'm not familiar with it either.
Oh, God. But... Oh, God. This is interesting. Just looked up on the IMDb. This is apparently a weird Russian science fiction post-apocalyptic film.
It sounds like right up our alley, right?
Now, this might be worth looking into. This, oh, wow, a small role by Bill Moseley, of all people.
Yeah.
So that's a strange... I mean, they're just... I'm often fascinated by film companies, record companies, anything like that. Like, I get big and then fall apart. Video game companies like ID Software. Companies that in a big way and then fall apart because of what made them get big. Canon Films is such a perfect example because 1986 is what shows why they were successful and why they fell apart. Because their business model is one that naturally makes money and naturally is unsustainable.
Right, yeah. And so, I mean, when they're covering the entire 1986 calendar, I mean, they're putting out a movie on the first of the year and then releasing one at the very last day of the year.
I mean, they've got, like, in most months, they have 3 to 4 films coming out. That's insane.
Yeah, so, I mean, they're pumping out movies more often than another distributor, but at the same time, like you said, how can you sustain that? And
I mean,
yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, it's like, I'm not sure what the numbers were then, but I mean, even now, people, the average American filmgoer sees about 3 to 3, maybe 4 films in a year in theater. I mean, it might have been different in the 80s because film tickets cost a lot less. Not as many people had home, had VCRs, had ways to watch things at home. So it may have been more, but the idea of putting out that many films, even if you're getting to different audiences, it's like, how could this conceivably make money? I mean, they're putting their money into very strange things. I mean, obviously films that are super low budget, that are completely, completely unsellable.
Yeah, exactly. Then, yeah, I mean, Roger Ebert, film critic, I mean, he once said no other production organization in the world today has taken more chances with serious marginal films than Canon.
Yeah, and then they're putting out, like, passion projects by very, often high-level filmmakers. I mean, 86, they released Roman Polanski's Pirates, which I have a standing rule on not seeing Polanski films. I don't know if this is any good, but I... it's a huge, huge failure. I mean, this was one where the budget spiraled. It made very little money at the box office. It killed the idea of pirate films for a good long time until Cutthroat Island, which again killed the idea of pirate films for a good long time. They made Franco Zeffirelli's Otello, which I haven't seen, but I'm really curious about this one. Yeah, I love his Romeo and Juliet, and probably my favorite part of Electric Boogaloo was when they talked to Zeffirelli about this, and he not only said it was his favorite film, but said that Golan and Globus were the only producers he had ever worked with who seemed to understand what he wanted.
Yeah.
Very highly regarded film, named Best Foreign Film of 86 by the, U.S. National Board of Review. It was nominated for...
Golden Globe.
Yeah. I think the only foreign film that actually had more buzz that year was Kurosawa's Ron, which is an absolute all-time classic. you know, this is a really well-regarded film. It's also the kind of thing that, theoretically, I mean, this is not, like, really repeatable. Like, something that, theoretically, Canon could have used to, you know, increase its reputation and attract other serious directors who wanted to do something in their own style.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's a good dropping off point there, Joel, because not long after this, it started to go downhill for them a little bit. And I think we're going to save that, because there's so much to talk about with Canon. I think we'll save that for the next episode. We'll get into the things and movies that occurred during the downslide of Canon films. What do you think?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, we've just sort of started the autopsy.
We're at the right now. They're releasing 45 movies a year, and so we're wondering how they can sustain that. Well, we're about to next week. We're going to find out exactly what went wrong.
Right. This week, where the doctor's telling our patient to, you know, get some more exercise and cut smoking, and next week we're the coroners.
That's right. We'll break this talk up into the next episode, which should be a fun one as well, because there's still plenty of good movies to talk about in that, as well as some of the decisions made that led to their downfall. With that, well, let's get to the final segment of the show, which is our double bill spill. Basically, we recommend a double bill for you. Two movies that are similar in theme. Maybe they have the same actor, same director. in some cases, the same plot. But this week, I'm going to go to 1991, and we'll go to Tony Scott's The Last Boy Scout, starring Bruce Willis and Damon Wayans. It kind of in the vein of a buddy cop movie, although neither guy is a cop. Bruce Willis plays a private detective, and Damon Wayans is an ex-football player looking for answers to the murder of his girlfriend, played by Halle Berry. And but, you know, it's the same vein. Two guys that initially don't get along. The chemistry between Bruce Willis and Damon Wayans in this movie is pretty good. I like the idea also that every character in this movie is flawed in some way. I mean, there are no virtuous characters in this story whatsoever, from Bruce Willis's private detective to, you know, Damon Wayans' ex-football player. He's hooked on, he does drugs, he's got in trouble with gambling. Bruce Willis's wife, played by Chelsea Field, is having an affair with Bruce Willis's friend, and the daughter, played by Danielle Harris, is also no treat in this movie. So we have a bunch of characters that they're just completely flawed. The villain in the movie, one of the main villains, played by Taylor Negron, he's awesome. He's awesome in most things that he's in, but playing the villain Milo in The Last Boy Scout, he's got some good one-liners in that film. I like the idea that, you know, the protagonist is really a sort of anti-hero in this movie. So, I mean, but you can still get behind them. Plus, there's a shitload of cussing in this movie. And so, my pick for this week on the Double Bill Spill is The Last Boy Scout.
And, you know, that's not one I've seen, but I'm a big fan of the writer, Shane Black, who, even those of our listeners who might not be familiar with the name know his work. I mean, the man wrote Lethal Weapon, he wrote Monster Squad, he wrote Last Action Hero, he was in Predator as Hawkins, and I believe he actually did some work on the script for that, but wasn't credited. And more recently, he's working on the next Predator film as a director and writer, and he's arguably the only man I've seen actually take a Marvel movie with Iron Man 3 and make it into his own movie.
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
It's very much Iron Man 3. It's not great, but it's very much a Shane Black film rather than a Marvel film that happens to have, like, Shane Black in the role of cooperative cog, like even a lot of other, you know, pretty, pretty decent directors have fulfilled for Marvel films with how assembly line those are. You know, I wish I could suggest another Shane Black film, but I think most of our listeners are probably familiar with anything, any major film of his I could suggest. I mean, we've all seen Predator. We've all seen Lethal Weapon 1 and 2 and Monster Squad. You know, all these films. So I think canon has affected me very detrimentally. I'm going to suggest possibly the worst buddy cop film you've ever seen, and that is Collision Course.
Yes.
The film, some of us may know it. It does get used in memes occasionally, or you'll see some of the negligible action scenes in YouTube clips. This is the film that dares to ask, what if you put Jay Leno with Pat Morita?
What if?
What if? The question we were all asking. It's actually this is one where I'd read more about the production, because it was made in 89, but wasn't released until 1992. There's apparently, I really need to look up this clip. Apparently, when Leno was guest host on The Tonight Show before he was full-time host, Pat Morita was on there, and they were talking about the making of film and how they had to stop filming because it ran out of money. I mean, there were still scenes, like major scenes that hadn't been shot there, you know, let alone editing, post-production, any of that. I mean, it's a weird case, because it's got real talent behind it. Lewis Teague directed it, who we talked about a few weeks ago with Cujo and Alligator, and also would have a pretty big hit not long after Collision Course was filmed, or at least initially filmed, with Navy SEALs. So you have that. You have Chris Sarandon has a villain. You've got Tom Noonan, the first Hannibal Lecter, and Frankenstein and the Monster Squad in a supporting role. You've got Ernie Hudson. I mean, I don't know how it's impossible to sell a film with Ernie Hudson in it, like, the year before Ghostbusters 2 came out.
Yeah, I mean, okay, so we ask, what if we hooked up Jay Leno with Pat Morita, but how does this movie miss, man?
It's just, I don't know if it's the budget thing, or just Pat Morita and Jay Leno on screen. It's, you know, it's not that they don't, like, have any kind of charisma together. It's just like, it's like if you put Hulk Hogan and Lauren Bacall on the movie together. There's just no rhyme or reason to it. And you're constantly questioning what you're seeing. I mean, the idea of Jay Leno as a cop is already asinine enough.
Right, yeah.
Like, I mean, yeah, maybe it could have been workable had you had, like, Pat Morita's a cop is fine. I mean, it's Pat Morita. I mean, he's, you know, I think by this point it was kind of a lost cause, because he was Mr. Miyagi no matter what.
Believe it was an attempt to, even though it was like several years after Karate Kid, more than likely it was an attempt to jump on the fame of Morita as Mr. Miyagi.
Oh yeah, I mean, Karate Kid was still a going concern at the time. I mean, I think the thing is, like, even though he was a, you know, veteran character actor, like, at that point you put him in anything that's not karate related and people don't know what the hell to think. And yeah, this is a film. I mean, it's set in Detroit. It's about Detroit. It's about the auto industry, which is really interesting. Interesting bit of really down to earth context for this kind of film, but the tone is very goofy and comedic. It's very, you know, post Beverly Hills Cop, post 48 Hours. It's, you know, not really serious, but it's about a serious thing, and it's actually filmed in Detroit, so the look is, you know, genuinely gritty. You've got like actual Detroit landmarks in there, like. It has the, like, an authentic, like, gritty urban feel, but the tone is just totally it's just dissonance the entire way through.
Yeah, so I think that's a good choice then, Joel. Last Boy Scout and Collision Course.
Roxy and I like to call a Collision Course finally the movie.
Great subtitle there. Yeah. All right. So I guess that concludes another show this week, and I've forgot the Sinful Dwarf.
Yeah, there were a lot of canon films to cover.
And the Sinful Dwarf was not one of them. And I, you know, every week I have to apologize, and I promise I am going to get the Sinful Dwarf as a topic on this show. So bear with me as I find some way to work the Sinful Dwarf in. I apologize.
One day we'll get there.
So once again, thank you for your time, Joel. Always appreciate it. We'll pick it up next week with the fall of canon films. And until then, remember your mom and pop video store, as it is the cornerstone of your nostalgia.